Hey, Dr. Taylor Marshall here, and thanks for listening to the Taylor Marshall Show. I have a different kind of a show for you today. It's actually an Ox Talk. An Ox Talk is a podcast that I do for the New St. Thomas Institute, which has some heavy-hitting theology in it. And today we look at St. Thomas Aquinas on the distinction between fish and meat during Lent. Why is it that apparently, according to the rules of the Catholic Church, you can have crab legs and lobster on a Friday, but you can't have a chicken nugget, some spam, or a hot dog? Why is that? Well, we look at Thomas Aquinas on the purpose of fasting and abstinence as it relates to our sexual libidos and how it relates to modern science regarding testosterone in our diet. So an interesting show today. We also look at the medieval rules for Lent and compare them to the modern rules for Lent. And let me tell you, the medieval rules are really difficult, very difficult. We also look at which translation the Eastern Catholic Church uses for its liturgical readings of the Bible. And we have a question from Xavier about the incubus and the succubus. The incubus is the female apparition of a demon. I'm sorry, the incubus is the male apparition of a demon, and the succubus is the female apparition of a demon, by which the demon tries to get a human to sin in having sex with that apparition. Sounds kind of crazy, I know, but St. Augustine talks about it. St. Thomas Aquinas talks about it. Even modern exorcists talk about this demonic apparition, a sexual apparition of a male to a female or a female to a male. And we'll look at that in this Ox Talk. So if you like this, join up at the New St. Thomas Institute. That's where we offer certificates in Catholic Church history, Church Fathers, medieval studies, biblical studies, apologetics, Catholic philosophy, theology, soon Old Testament, all kinds of resources, videos, audio, PDFs, books, church fathers, Bibles, resources, everything you need, all packaged together. So check it out at newstthomas.com. And here's the Ox Talk on Aquinas and Lent. I hope you enjoy it. God bless. You're listening to Ox Talk Radio, the official podcast of the New St. Thomas Institute. This is Dr. Taylor Marshall, and I welcome all of you back, the students, the mighty, mighty musk oxen of the New St. Thomas Institute. Today, we're looking at the theology of Lent, and who better to help us than St. Thomas Aquinas? We're going to look at how Lent has changed over the centuries. We're going to look at Lent in the medieval era, specifically in the 1200s when Thomas Aquinas was alive. Look at those rules and then compare them to the super easy rules we have in our time period. And we're going to look at this question that we hear asked every year at Lent, and that is, why is it okay to eat seafood on a day of abstinence but not meat? Why can I enjoy lobster and halibut and flounder and a shrimp cocktail, but I can't have a steak or a hot dog or a chicken nugget? Well, Thomas Aquinas has an answer for that, and we're going to look at it. Plus, we have a couple other questions from you, the members, the students of the New St. Thomas Institute. Xavier asked about the demonic succubus and the demonic incubus. Look at what those are and if they're actually possible. And we have a couple other questions, one relating to the Bible translation used in the Eastern Catholic churches. So let's go ahead and get started. All right, so Ray asks, why is seafood but not meat allowed during Lent? Seems kind of unfair that you could sit down and have a $30 lobster meal on a Friday in Lent, but you couldn't eat a can of Spam, right? There's one's high quality, one's low quality. And so we have this distinction that seems arbitrary in the Catholic Church. And so we need to ask ourselves, is there a good reason for this? Is there a theology there? Is it just some rule that some monks made up or some old cardinals came up with one day? Thomas Aquinas says that, first of all, before we get into the whole thing about fish and seafood and its different kind of flesh, the spirit of Lent is always out of mortification and penance. And so from the onset, it shouldn't be that you're having these glorious lobster dinners on Friday during Lent. That's you're obeying the rules, but it's kind of against the spirit of Lent. But that being said, I want to go into this distinction between meat and flesh meats and fish. Now, Thomas Aquinas gives two theological reasons. And the first he says is that Christ offered his flesh on the wood of the cross. And so since Christ gave up his flesh for us, we give up flesh for him. Now, we're not going to be killed on a cross. And so what we do to symbolize that or signify it is we give up eating flesh. All right. And then the second reason for no meat requires a bit more explanation. But that first one right there, I think, is a great one to share with your family, your friends, especially your children, and say, look, Jesus offered up his flesh on Good Friday. And so we are offering up the eating of flesh, which tastes so good, meat, to correspond and to give back to Jesus in a very small way. Now, the second reason, Thomas says, fasting was instituted by the church in order to bridle the concupiscence of the flesh, which regard pleasures of touch and connections with food and sex. And I'll pause right there. So, fasting is made to bridle concupiscence. And there's that word concupiscence. We study it a lot in the New St. Thomas Institute. Concupiscence is what's left over after baptism. So we are conceived in original sin. That means we don't have grace. We are not ordered properly in our passions or in our intellect. And we lack the sanctifying grace to get into heaven. And so the remedy for that is justification. And justification is instrumentalized through a sacrament, and that is baptism. So when you're baptized, you receive righteousness. That is, you are justified. You receive sanctifying grace. That is, you are sanctified. And the stain of original sin, which is really the lack of grace, is gone because you now are full of grace. Unfortunately, concupiscence remains. So we have 8 children. We've baptized all of them, and they all grew up to be little stinkers at point because they sin. And even before they can sin at the age of reason, they're still doing naughty things like telling little lies, stealing cookies, pushing down their little brothers and sisters, taking away toys, not sharing, having hissy fits, etc. Their passions are not properly ordered to reason. And even when they are more reasonable at the age of 7, 8, 9, 10, they continue to do naughty things and act according to their passions and not according to the law of God. And this mystery is concupiscence. It is the lust of the flesh. St. Paul talks about it in Romans 6 and 7, where he says, you know, look, we were baptized, we're justified in Christ, and we do things that we don't want to do. Now, in the Blessed Virgin Mary, she was conceived immaculate in her mother's womb, in St. Anne's womb, and so she was justified in the moment of her conception. But unlike us, God also removed concupiscence. So the Blessed Virgin Mary never acted naughty, never acted in a disharmonious way with her passions. She was always in accord with reason, always in accord with the law of God. We who are baptized, even as infants, you know, you've heard it said, vipers in diapers. We still have this disorderness in us, and that's concupiscence, and it stays with us until the moment of death. To the very last day, you will have these disordered passions, these disordered emotions. In the New St. Thomas Institute, I say concupiscence is that thing in you where you've eaten half a pint of ice cream, you've already hit the 400, 500 calorie mark, and you're like, I just can't stop. I'm going to go to the bottom of this pint and eat the entire pint of ice cream. Or you're sitting, maybe you're like me, you like Tex-Mex down here in Texas. You're at the table and you've ordered yourself something for dinner, fajitas or a taco plate, and they bring out chips and salsa ahead of the meal. And you're snacking on the chips and you think to yourself, I've eaten almost half a basket of chips. If I keep eating these chips, this is your mind thinking, I'm not going to be hungry for my meal. Yeah, but you just keep eating them, and you eat a basket and a half of chips and salsa, and then your meal comes, and then you feel bad, and you eat that, and then you're stuffed, and you feel gross, gluttony, right? That's concupiscence. Or you're driving down the road, and someone cuts you off, and you want to give them the bird. That's concupiscence. You see an attractive person who's not your spouse, and your eyes want to follow that person and undress that person with your mind. That is concupiscence. all of these interior temptations. See, temptations come exterior and interior. Exterior is like, hey, you, come over here and do these drugs. That's an exterior temptation, someone on the outside. An interior temptation doesn't require any third party. These are just disordered movements within the soul with your 11 passions. And if you want to learn more of that, go to the New St. Thomas Institute lesson, How Your Soul Works, according to Thomas Aquinas, and we break down the 11 passions and how this whole phenomenon works of eating too much ice cream and too many chips as it relates to sin, the sacraments, justification, sanctification, and finally salvation and becoming a saint. So concupiscence is left over, and God on purpose left it there for us to have a battle, to have a war our entire life between the grace in our souls and our rationality and the emotional passions, our animal bestial side, our instincts. And this battle that we do throughout life is what brings us to sainthood, sanctification. It's the vocation that every single one of us have in baptism, and that is to fight the flesh, to overcome those emotions, those passions, those instincts that are disordered because of original sin, because of Adam and Eve, and to order them to Christ and to see Mary as an immaculate model. So a new Adam and a new Eve versus an old Adam and an old Eve. That's Catholicism in a nutshell right there, and that's why we have the seven sacraments. So Thomas Aquinas assumes that you know everything I just said, and now you know it if you didn't know it. And he says the reason that the church has fasting and abstinence is to bridle concupiscence with regard to pleasures, quote, of touch, that touch in connection with food and sex. Because the two most powerful forces in you as a mammal, as a member of the animal kingdom, we are rational animals. We are animals that have souls. We are spiritual animals. We have nostrils like a dog, and we have hair on our body, and we have lungs that are similar to anything else, any other mammal that breathes, except we have a metaphysical mind. We have a soul. We have a spirit given to us that was blown into us in our creation there at Adam. And we receive one anytime the egg and the sperm come together and form a new human person. God breathes a new soul into that person. And because we are physical, which is good, and we do have an animal body that has blood and a heartbeat, just like all the other mammals, we are called to eat so that we stay alive, and we are called to have sex so that our species stay alive. If you stop eating, you individually die, and if we stop having sex, our entire human species will die. It will go extinct. So there's these powerful forces inside of us, just as there are in squirrels and dogs and cats and camels, to eat and to have sex. And because of sin, we have a unbridled desire for food, hence obesity, and sex, hence fornication, adultery, and all the other perversions associated with sex. And so Thomas Aquinas goes on to say, therefore the church forbade those who fast to partake of those food which both afford the most pleasure to the palate and besides are a great incentive to lust. What he says here is that meat gives us the most pleasure, and eating meat gives us an incentive to lust. He goes on to say, quote, such are the flesh of animals that take their rest on the earth, and of those that breathe the air and their products, such as milk, and from those that walk on the earth, and eggs from birds. For since such like animals are more like a human in body, they afford greater pleasure as food and greater nourishment of the body, and that from their consumption there result a greater surplus available for seminal matter. And seminal matter, he means semen, male semen. And actually, according to Thomas's biology, he would also associate seminal matter with the female fluids as well. That's a whole nother talk. We have a New St. Thomas Institute lesson on that. It's on the formation of Adam and Eve and whether women are misformed males. They're not, by the way. But we have a whole video on on that as well. But anyway, so seminal matter would for Thomas include both male reproductive fluids and female reproductive fluids. Thomas goes on, which, when abundant, becomes a great incentive to lust. Hence, the church has bidden those who fast to abstain especially from these foods. And quote, I'll stop here, pause, a little commentary. So he says, look, there are animals in the animal kingdom that are more like us than others. And so he says the animals that live on the earth with us and breathe air like us, they give us more pleasure for food because they're just more like us. And they give us better nourishment. And from this nourishment, we get a surplus of the seminal fluid, of the reproductive fluids. And when we have, for the male, more semen or more, more fluids, more wetness for the woman, there's a greater incentive for lust. That's the exact word. Actually, Thomas says a great incentive for lust is his words in the Latin. And so the church says, well, let's reduce those kind of foods so that there's a reduction in lust. And we do this once a year to sort of reset our passions, reset our lusts and our desires for both food and for sex. So, I bet you weren't expecting that answer. And there is a bit of science to what Thomas Aquinas says. For example, if you want to, the primary hormone in the body for sexual reproduction is testosterone, both for the male and the female. Yes, of course, estrogen is more important for the female. However, even in a healthy female, she has more testosterone in her than she does estrogen, though she has a lot more estrogen in her compared to a male. And the female libido and the male libido is basically a combination of testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone. And all of these work together in the male and the female to produce a libido. And it is true that eating meat increases testosterone in males and in females, especially eating high-fat cholesterol meats. Testosterone, estrogen are actually derived from the cholesterol molecule if you look at it in a chemistry book. Or you can go online and look at the transformation of or the formation of hormones in the human body or in mammals in general. It begins with cholesterol. It begins with the fats. And so people who eat a very low fat diet, very low cholesterol diet, and lack a lot of things like iron and zinc, which are higher in red meat, will naturally have a lower testosterone. And a lower testosterone usually means a lower libido. Did Thomas Aquinas know any of this science? No. But they did note, these guys are monks. They have been dealing with libido and lust for centuries, and there was a bro science, a monk science amongst them, even in the convents as well, of diets and ways of living that reduce lust, that reduced libido. And so they knew, and we know today, if you eat a bunch of salad and a bunch of soy, and tofu, carrots, and you do that for a whole month, and whether you're male or female, and you go get your testosterone tested at the beginning, and then you get it tested at the end, your testosterone will be lower. If you fast, if you eat less, if you take out zinc and iron and cholesterol, what's available to your body to produce testosterone will go down. So Thomas Aquinas, who sat, by the way, under Albert the Great, St. Albert the Great. And Albert the Great was Europe's premier biologist. And it may be a little medieval, but Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas, too, under him, they studied fertility. They studied biology. They studied zoology in the animal kingdom. And they were aware of what raised and lowered libido. And you can find these same kind of things today. It's just that we have the actual science. It's also kind of interesting that over time, it's almost intuitive that terms for our sexual libido are associated with food. For example, if you said, he's red-blooded. That's kind of he's a you know, like a red-blooded guy. He's kind of lusty, right? Hot-blooded, same kind of thing. A stud, a bull, red meat, meaty, muscular, brawn, which originally, you know, brawn meat originally meant a roast meat. So all of these terms are both related to food, mainly meat foods, and they have these concepts, kind of euphemisms for fertility or for virility. Now, what about lobsters and oysters? They're not really fish. And Thomas Aquinas recognized this problem. By the way, you can find this in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae, question 30, article 1. Thomas writes, "Further, some fish are as delectable to eat as the flesh of certain animals. Now, concupiscence is the desire of the delectable." And Thomas goes on to write that the church rules regarding this in general, that eating flesh meat is generally more desirable than eating fish foods. And if you doubt that, just count the number of burger restaurants in your town. Take burger restaurants, steak houses, fried chicken restaurants, and compare that to the number of Long John Silver franchises in your neighborhood, and you'll see that humans in general do prefer to eat pork and especially meat, cow, and chicken more than they like, in general, fish. And of course, lobster is much better than Long John Silver's. It's even better than a hot dog. And that's why I say it's probably a good rule of thumb to avoid lobster or crab in the spirit of penance. And Thomas Aquinas grants that, and he also says, look, we need to be careful, and the term he uses is the desire of the delectable. The delectable. So if you're in, if it's a Friday in Lent and you're not eating meat and someone says, well, let's just have crab legs, that's delectable. You want to opt for the nasty fish sticks instead with tartar sauce. Go with that. Also, same thing goes for, you know, I've had people say, well, what about wine? Yes, of course, drinking a $100 bottle of wine on a Friday in Lent is contrary to the spirit of Lent. So, you know, a lot of this is the heart, not the law. We humans are really good whenever a law or a rule is written down in the church or in civil politics, in political law, to study it and then quickly figure out the loopholes and how it can benefit us and how we can get around it. And that applies to the fasting rules in the church as well. And so we need to have a spirit of penance, spirit of sacrifice. But in general, the answer is humans prefer to eat meat that's more like them than less like them. And hence, humans prefer steak, chicken, and ham than they do to fish. Now let's look at some of the rules in Thomas Aquinas' time in the 1200s. Compare them to our own time. Now Lent is a 46-day period of fasting. It's 40 days plus 6 Sundays. In the Roman Church, the Eastern Church is different. And in the old days, Ash Wednesday, which was the first day, and Good Friday were called black fasts. Black fast. And a black fast means no food at all. Nothing, nada. You wake up, you don't eat anything, you go to sleep, you don't eat anything. That's a black fast. Today, obviously it's different. You just get one meal and two collations. We'll talk about collations in just a little bit, where those come from. Now, in Thomas Aquinas' time, the rest of the days in Lent, you could eat no food until 3 p.m. And Thomas Aquinas says the reason is Jesus died at 3 p.m. And since Jesus was suffering in his passion all day until 3 p.m. when he died, we suffer with hunger all day until 3 p.m. And this practice, by the way, was not just medieval. It's not just the 1200s. It goes all the way back to the 400s at least. So the church historian Socrates, this is not Socrates, the Greek philosopher. This is Socrates, the church historian. He's in the 400s. He wrote an ecclesial history. If you look at book 5, you'll see him there describing the practice of Lent. And he says, look, Christians don't eat till 3 p.m., the hour of mercy. In Thomas's time, there was no animal meat and no fats, no lard. So if you were eating something that had animal lard in it, even if it was like a cupcake and had lard in it, no good. No fats. Fish was allowed. We already discussed that and why that was. Another thing to remember is in the old days, they didn't have refrigerators. So it wasn't like you caught a fish on Monday, you put it in the fridge and you ate it and it was basically still almost sushi grade on Thursday. If you caught a fish in the morning, by dinner time, that fish is getting funky. It's not good. And so what they did is they would salt the fish. And that just meant you shoved a ton of salt inside and on the outside of it so it wouldn't begin to rot. But it still began to decompose and it wasn't that great and it was super salty. You know, nowadays we say if fish tastes fishy, it's gone bad. Well, in the 1200s, all the fish tastes fishy all the time. Unless you just pulled it from the stream or just pulled it from the ocean and ate it within a few hours, your fish was fishy. So definitely more penitential than it is now. Also, Thomas says no eggs. Eggs come from a chicken. Chicken is meat. So, no. Also, no dairy products. They called this lactosinia. Lactosinia is anything that's lactose-based, anything dairy. So this means no milk, no cream, no cheese, no cream cheese, no butter, nothing. Now, there is an interesting exception to this. Before the Christians of the British Isles hooked up with Rome again through St. Augustine of Canterbury and Gregory the Great, they did, it seems, use dairy products and eat dairy products during Lent and perhaps eggs during Lent. But once the Roman influence came after around the year 600 in the British Isles, this came to an end. There was no more dairy, no more eggs. Interestingly enough, wine and beer are allowed during Lent. And while wine and beer can help us lose our inhibitions, which is bad, wine and beer, alcohol, actually does decrease testosterone in a human, so or any animal. So I don't think Thomas Aquinas or Albert the Great or any of the medievals probably didn't know that, but we know it today. Also, medieval Europeans during this time, they basically saw Lent as eating dry food. There was not a lot of cooking during Lent because there was not much needed to be cooked. So basically during Lent, since you couldn't eat anything dairy, any milk or cream, you couldn't eat eggs, no sauces related to eggs, or even hard-boiled. By the way, that's why there's Easter eggs. You hadn't had an Easter egg, you hadn't had an egg in 46 days, so you were so obsessed with the egg, you actually painted it, made it look pretty, and gave it to your friend, and it was a big deal because you hadn't had an egg in 46 days. That's the Easter egg. It has nothing to do with bunnies that lay eggs. It has everything to do with medieval fasting laws. So there wasn't a lot of cooking. The only thing you were cooking during Lent was bread. You know, bread was grain and water. You mixed that up, some yeast. You had vegetables and fruit. Not a lot of fruit because not a lot of fruit's coming up at this time of year. In the spring it's starting to, but it's not really arrived. So you're eating some vegetables, maybe some dried fruit. They ate salt to help keep themselves going. It's kind of like electrolytes, a form of Gatorade to help them during their fast. So they would consume salt, bread, dried fruit, vegetables. That's about it. People lost weight. People were walking. They're exercising way more than we are. They're not driving in cars. They're walking through the village. They're walking in the fields. They're doing everything that they normally do on much lower caloric intake. Another interesting thing about Lent is there was no sexual intercourse between spouses during Lent. It was a time of no sex. This was when husbands and wives gave each other a peck on the cheek on Ash Wednesday and said, see you on Easter, babe, because that was it. And pagan kings that married pretty Catholic princesses were pretty upset to learn about this. It's probably not something that was forthcoming in the nuptial negotiations. But yeah, the Catholic princess was not in the bedroom of the king, pagan king, during Lent. So no sexual contact during that time period. Also, in our time period, there's this big idea, Sundays don't count. Sundays are our time of resurrection, which is true, by the way. So Sundays are off. Well, that would mean that you had the 6 Sundays of the 46 days were freebies. Not so in the 1200s. The 6 Sundays of Lent were relaxed liturgically, so it was a little less penitential on Sundays in Lent than it was on, say, a Friday or a Saturday or a Wednesday in Lent, but it was still fasting and abstinence on the Sunday. No breaks. Just a little bit more levity on Sunday because it's a day of resurrection. Remember, it's still a purple vestment on Sunday in Lent. It doesn't go to gold or white on the Sundays of Lent. It stays purple, which meant, hey, you people in the pews, lay people, you're still fasting, you're still having abstinence. And for Holy Week, as I mentioned before, Good Friday was a black fast, no food at all. And many would begin this fast from the evening of Maundy Thursday, Holy Thursday, which is when Christ had the Last Supper. They would begin their fast at that point. They would go all Friday as a black fast, no food, no raisins, no toast, nothing. And then they would break it about noon on Saturday. In the medieval period, it's interesting, the Easter Vigil, which we celebrate now at midnight, in the old days would usually be celebrated around noon on Saturday, and people would break their Lenten fast around noonday, midday on Saturday, and that would begin Easter. Would be on that Saturday. It was really in the 1900s that the ancient patristic Easter Vigil was moved back to midnight to connect it with Sunday. So, pretty hardcore, isn't it? No sex, no dairy, no eggs, no meat for 46 days. Ash Wednesday and Good Friday are black fasts. No food. So what began to change? How did it get so weak? You know, nowadays, we only have 2 fast days, and that's Ash Wednesday and Friday, but you get to have 1 meal and 2 snacks on that day. And then the Fridays in Lent are no meat, but that's it. That's all we have to do. Compared to what the medievals did, wow, like ours is completely weakened up. Well, it started to become more lax in the 800s. This would be the time of Charlemagne. This is another time of great conversion in Europe, of bringing in new tribes, new peoples into conformity with Roman Catholicism. And we, in the English-speaking language, we refer to 12 o'clock as noon, N-O-O-N. That's actually a corruption of the Latin word nones, which is the ninth hour, 3 p.m. So what happened is, lay people and even monks, especially monks actually, they could start eating in Lent after they recited nones, the 3 p.m. liturgy of the hours. And so they just began celebrating, well, I'm kind of hungry today. Let's not wait till 3 p.m. Let's just do it at 2 p.m. That way when we're done, we can start eating. Liturgically, it will have anticipated 3 p.m. And they said, well, let's do it at 1 p.m. Well, I'm really hungry. Let's do it at noon. And so nones began to be celebrated. The third hour began to be celebrated at the sixth hour, which is 12 o'clock, 12 p.m. And so nones moved up to 12, and that's why we call 12 noon. It has everything to do with fasting and actually cheating the fast and moving up the timeline 3 hours to break the fast every day during Lent. Also, the thing about dairy products, in Germany, the bishops in the medieval era started giving dispensations to the laity so that they could consume dairy in their house, milk, butter, cream. And this was a fundraising technique. It was supposed to be, you know, if you did a good deed, you could get this dispensation. But by good deed, they meant make a donation to help build a bridge or help build a cathedral, or help, you know, renovate a church. And so wealthy Catholics in Germany would make this donation. They'd basically pay a fee to the diocese, and then they'd be issued a dispensation where in their home they could serve cream and butter. So if you went over to their house, they had the dispensation, you could have milk or butter or cream. And that's a big deal when all you're eating is bread and vegetables. So it was a popular fundraising technique by the German bishops. It's always the German bishops who are trying to cheat. What's going on over there in Germany, huh? And they've got good fundraising techniques for sure. The German bishops have never lacked for funds in the history of Catholicism. The Germans always ensure that they are always getting rich somehow. And we can see it already with this darn butter tax, this butter fee that they started in the medieval era. Also, there were in the monasteries weaker monks, older monks, who had a hard time making the fast all day. So they would break it at 3 p.m., they'd have a meal, but then later on, they'd be hungry again and be getting weak. Now, in the monasteries, they would read St. John Cassian's book, Collations. And so the monks were allowed during this time period to have a little food. And so this snack became known as a collation because it was eaten in conjunction with Cassian's Collations, and the term stuck. So today, we say on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, you can have one meal and you can have two collations. And by collations, we mean a little snack. You can have it in the morning or in the evenings, but you're allowed two snacks and one meal. Also, with the coming of the New World, tea and coffee became very popular in the Old World. And it became allowable to drink tea or coffee in the morning. Technically, this would have been violating the fast because you're doing it before 3 p.m. But things got soft and said, yeah, you can have your morning coffee or tea because you need that caffeine in the morning. And also over time, the popes allowed meat to be eaten on other days of the week. Friday always remained meatless, but they started opening up. Okay, well, you know, on Sundays, first they said, okay, on Sundays in Lent you can have meat. And then they added Monday and Tuesday and Thursday and Saturday and then finally Wednesday. And then finally only Friday was meatless. And it was in 1966 that Pope Paul VI in his apostolic constitution changed the Lenten practice to what it is today. And I've already stated it, but I'll say it one more time. No meat, only fish on Fridays in Lent, and one meal and two collations, that is snacks, allowed on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. Boom. That's it. So ask yourself, could you hang in 1200 or 800 as a Catholic? Imagine on Ash Wednesday putting away all eggs, all dairy, all meat, and you just have bread and toast and zucchinis and maybe some bananas. That's it. Salad. That's it. Could you make it? I actually did one Lent where I did no meat. I still did dairy, but I did no meat, and it was extremely difficult. I lost several pounds, and I felt weak, and it was hard. So I kind of know the feeling, but I think adding in no dairy, and then also for the married people, no relations, it's a pretty big deal. So I think somehow in the church we need to get more strict. I don't know how we do it, though. If you have an idea, leave a comment. Okay, so moving on to just a couple closing questions. One of them here is from Xavier. Xavier says, when I was in seminary, I lived with an exorcist. We had to read a bunch of books like the ones from Father Gabriel Amorth and Jose Antonio Fortea. If I remember correctly, I read something about the possibility of demons having sex with human beings. I even recall the names of succubus and incubus. I would be interested to know more about it. Okay, so this is actually something that's in a lot of demonology. Thomas Aquinas grants that it is a reality. I would have to defer an exorcist on this point. I always thought it would not be physically possible until I read Thomas Aquinas on it. And here's what he says. Okay, so there's a succubus and an incubus. A succubus, basically this is Latin, cubus, C-U-B-U-S, comes from the Latin word to lie down, to lie, right? Like a cubiculum in Latin is a bedroom. It's where you lie down to go to sleep. So a succubus is a subcubus, under, lying down underneath, and an incubus is lying on top of or into. So in demonology, a succubus is a demon who appears as a really attractive, sexy woman who tempts a man to mate with it. So it's an apparition of a demon looking like a beautiful woman, and a human male actually has intercourse with this apparition. So that female demonic apparition is called a succubus. Remember, it's lying on the bottom. And an incubus is the exact opposite. An incubus is a demon who appears as a really attractive man and incites lust in a female and then mates with the human female. So it's a demonic apparition of a male that mates physically with the female. Now, the obvious problem here is that angels and demons are fallen angels. They have no physicality. They are not incarnate. Jesus Christ is incarnate of the Virgin Mary as the second person of the Trinity. Demons do not become incarnate. They don't take on flesh, and they can't be born of a woman because that would take a miracle, an incarnation, and only God allows that. So how are these things happening? Well, Thomas Aquinas allows for the existence of the incubus and the succubus. He actually appeals to St. Augustine on the matter. If you want to learn more about this, just check out Summa Theologiae, first part, question 51. I think it's article 3 down in the objections there. I can't quite remember, but that's where he appeals to Augustine and says, look, people have interacted with these demonic male-female shapes. In fact, if you ever read King Arthur, Merlin is often said to be the offspring of an incubus an incubus kind of situation. Also, there's a story in the medieval era about a pope, Pope Sylvester, who was the pope from 999 to 1003, and he had a demon that he worked with, a succubus, who he would mate with, a female demon, or a female-looking demon, named Mary Diana. And Mary Diana is the demon, his consort, sexual, demonic mate, who helped him become pope. Now, this is apocryphal, probably not true. Don't take this to the bank, but it is a medieval legend, and something used to tarnish the reputation of Pope Sylvester II at the turn of the first millennium. So this idea is in Catholic theology, Catholic tradition. How does it happen? Well, Thomas Aquinas and others speculate that what happens is the demon will concentrate light or matter or dust in the region in order to form what appears to be a body, but it's a fake body. So the demons are able to manipulate light and color and hues and shades and also matter around them, dust, to sort of build up and create what could be seen as a body, also deceive the senses of the male, the human male or the human female in that situation. And it's further speculated, and this is where we get really kind of deep into speculation. I don't feel comfortable with it at all. And that is, it's speculated by some medievals that a succubus, so that's the female apparition of the demon, would mate with a male, capture that male's semen, hold on to the semen, turn into an incubus, that is a male apparition of a demon, find the female, mate with the female, and use that deposit of the male semen in order to pregnate the woman so that there would be a way of conceiving. This is like in vitro fertilization, demonic style. I honestly, as a philosopher, I don't really see this working, but it was speculated. So this is the idea of the incubus and the succubus. There is nothing official in Catholic magisterial teaching on this. It is present in Augustine. It's present in medieval folklore. I think it might even be referred to in Canterbury Tales by Chaucer. And it is attested to in Thomas Aquinas. And it is attested to, as Xavier mentions here, in the writings of modern exorcists. It'd be really interesting to get a real-life exorcist operating today and see if he's ever come across a case of an incubus or succubus situation. I don't know. I'm not that well-versed. And I do know exorcists, and I do know that they are very reserved in telling stories or giving any details about the demonic realm. I think that's for our protection. So there's probably a reason why we don't know too much about this, but it is in the Catholic tradition. It is very interesting. I would warn you, though, don't get too into it. It's kind of weird. It's kind of perverted. Let's just leave it to The Exorcist, all right? And then we'll close with we got a couple more things here. A quick one here is Peter. He watched our new St. Thomas Institute lesson on which Bible translations should Catholics use. And he had a good question, and he said, what do the Eastern Catholic churches use in their liturgy? The Latin Catholics, we use the NAB, and I don't like the NAB for certain reasons. I gave examples of that in that video lesson. And it's also true that the Eastern Catholics in the English-speaking liturgies also use the NAB. And I know many Eastern Catholics, one of which is a deacon, and he laments the NAB as well. I think specifically in some of their canonical hymns and in their liturgical music, which depends more on the Septuagint, the NAB fails in a lot of ways for their liturgy. So that's unfortunate. Maybe over time, however, that can be reformed and revised. I know that the Eastern Orthodox in the United States basically took the New King James, brought it into conformity with Orthodox theology and spirituality, and they totally redid the Psalter, the Psalms, and put it in translation in conformity with the Septuagint Psalter so that it would match up with the liturgical music. Brilliant plan. I actually really, kind of just between us, I really like the Orthodox Study Bible. To be honest, I actually carry it with me. I really like it. The notes are sometimes anti-Catholic, but the patristic quotes along the way are really good. I wanted to bring that up. This is the good thing about the Ox Talk, because I say things in the Ox Talks that I don't always say in the videos. In the video, I wanted to recommend the Orthodox Study Bible, but I thought, you know, as a Catholic Institute, we shouldn't be recommending anything not Catholic. But I, myself, do like the Orthodox Study Bible, because so much of the commentary in it says, as St. Athanasius said, as St. John Chrysostom says, as St. Gregory of Nazianzus wrote, and it kind of links up all this biblical theology with church father theology. So I like it for that. Though, warning, trigger warning, if you're reading the Orthodox Study Bible and you go to Matthew 16 and read, "You are Peter, on this rock I will build my church," you will be sorely disappointed and offended by what the Orthodox have written there. So to answer your question, Peter, the Eastern Catholics use the NAB as well. And we'll close here. I found a great quote this week. I was going through the comments, and a priest in NSTI wrote a really nice comment. I wanted to share it with you. And the reason I want to share it with you is I want you to encourage any seminarians or deacons or priests who might want resources. Tell them about New St. Thomas Institute. Tell them what you're getting out of it. We have priests who get New St. Thomas Institute memberships for all their staff, for their deacons, for their continuing ed, for RCIA. We have convents where all the nuns are doing NSTI. So it's not just lay people. We have priests and deacons and seminarians and nuns and sisters and monks taking these classes and kind of doing a refresher. So Father Paul, he left this comment. He said, "Dear Dr. Marshall, in Christ, you're truly a gifted teacher. Your explanations are clear and illuminating. It is a gift to be able to clearly explain St. Thomas Aquinas in such a very down-to-earth way. I've been enjoying the course and refreshing my memory on things I studied 33 years ago in the seminary. It is always important for a priest to be doing some fine-tuning. Thank you for such a wonderful opportunity. I am grateful for you offering all these online courses. May God bless you in all that you do to give people a deeper knowledge of the faith. Be assured of my prayers for you, for your family, and for all the students. I count on yours, Father Paul." So pray for Father Paul. Pray for all of our priests who are here in the New St. Thomas Institute, our deacons, our religious. And I asked Father Paul, I thanked him for that and asked him to pray for me and for all of us and to remember us at the altar when he's celebrating Mass especially. We also had a great comment from a Catholic bishop. I won't share his name, but he's a Catholic bishop here in the U.S., and he wrote a really nice note to me about the apologetics program and the apologetics videos that we do. So it's encouraging after all these years at NSTI to see priests and even a bishop noticing NSTI and giving their blessing on the resources and what we're trying to accomplish here. So thank you all for being a member. Thank you for your prayers and for your kind notes. And most of all, thank you for just sharing your progress. I love hearing from you guys and seeing you move through the certificates. And when you earn your certificates, I love congratulating you and seeing you and you sharing it in the community and in the forums. It's a great encouragement to me. We make all these videos. It's wonderful to see them consumed and put to action. So thanks for listening to this Ox Talk. Until next time, remember that our Lord Jesus Christ said that you are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. So go out there and be salty. So there it is. That's an Ox Talk. If you like it, if you want to get more of those, a couple dozen more of those, just go over to newstthomas.com, sign up, and check it out. Join over 3,000 students in the largest Catholic online institute in the world. I'll be in there ready to greet you and get you on the journey, getting started with some certificates. God bless. Bye.